Chapter 14, The Mouse Conference. Finally, at 3 p.m. on the 5th of November 1992, the brothers met. It was 8 years since they had last seen each other, and their genes had decided on different futures. Milat was shocked by the differences: the nose, the eyes, the mouth. His brother was a stranger to him, and he told him this. "Only because you wish me to be," replied Majid cleverly. But Milat was not interested in mind games. "So you're going to keep helping him, yeah?" Majid lifted his hands. "Yes, I want to help Marcus where I can. It is a great project." "It's a terrible project," shouted Milat, pulling out a chair and sitting on it backwards. "I prefer to see it as correcting the creator's mistakes," replied Majid carefully. "The creator doesn't make mistakes," said Milat. "So you and Kevin mean to continue?"
"Yeah, of course we do."
"And so do I." And then the brothers began to argue. Sometimes they shouted. Sometimes one laughed at this or that idea. They talked about history, past, present, and future, and every memory, every argument, every belief they had ever known. It went on, and neither could win. On the 20th of December at midnight, the phone rang in the Jones house. Irie, who was now living back at home, came downstairs in her nightdress and picked it up.
"Irie? Is that you?"
said Hortense's voice.
"I've phoned to warn you."
"Warn me about what?" asked Irie.
"Irie, I repeat, I have phoned to warn you."
"Look, I can't. Gran, I'm really tired. Could this wait until..."
"There are days when the Lord wants us to warn the lost," Hortense continued. "This is one of them. There will be more."
Then she started to cry.
"Please, do not get involved with this man."
"What man?" And suddenly, she heard Ryan Topps's voice as he picked up the other phone.
"The scientist, Chalfin," he said. "The man you call a friend. He is playing with the Lord's creations."
"Marcus," said Irie, "I'm not involved with him. I just answer his phone and do his filing."
"Then you are the secretary for evil. You are lower than the lowest," said Ryan Topps.
"Marcus is simply trying to find answers to diseases like cancer," she explained. "He isn't evil."
"He is a soldier in the army of evil,"
she heard Hortense shout.
"And he is at the front. I am very disappointed in you, Irie."
"We will be seeing you at the Future Mouse Conference then," said Ryan. "We will use it to get our message heard. The world's media will be there, and so will we."
"We're going to sing nice prayers there with a guitar," added Hortense excitedly, "because a piano is too heavy to carry. And we're going to go on hunger strike until that man stops playing with the Lord's creations."
"And you're going to let her do that, are you, Ryan?" asked Irie angrily.
"She's 85, Ryan, 85. She can't go on hunger strike."
Irie heard Ryan turn and tell Hortense to go to bed. But just before she put down the phone, she could hear her grandmother singing.
"The Lord gives and the Lord takes. He gives with his right hand and takes with his left."
"But most of the time, he just takes," thought Irie. "He just bloody takes." It was 5 p.m. on the 31st of December 1992, the day of the Future Mouse Conference. Joshua was sitting in a van with 10 nervous friends from Fate. They were on their way from Willesden to the Perret Institute in Trafalgar Square. "By 1999, read Crispin, who was Fate's leader,
More than 15 million people will have seen the Future Mouse exhibition, and many more will be following it in the media.
There's a picture here of Chalfin's head attached to a goat's body and a pig's legs, said Jolie, holding a newspaper.
Nice, replied Crispin, and then he pointed at another picture.
Look at that one. He looks more Chalfinist than ever.
Joshua deeply regretted telling Crispin about this little joke his family shared about their name. It had seemed like a good idea at the time. Make everybody laugh and show which side he was on. But now he felt shame. He had not really understood what he was doing to his father until he heard that word come out of Crispin's mouth.
So, have we got everything we need? Asked Crispin.
Yeah, said one of the other members, and he lifted up the bag that held the gun.
All done.
Jolie, who Joshua fancied, but who was Crispin's girlfriend, passed Joshua a cigarette.
I think you're really brave, she said. I don't know if I could do it, if it was my father. Obviously, my first love is animals, and it's Crispin's too, so there's no problem. It's easy for us. But you've made the most difficult decision out of us all, and you seem so calm.
Jolie kept talking, and Joshua kept nodding his head. He knew that he seemed calm from the outside, but inside he seemed to be feeling empty, as if it was not really happening. What he was about to do to his father was so enormous he could not imagine anything after that. The world happens to you, he thought. You don't happen to the world. There's nothing you can do. For the first time in his life, he truly believed that, and he knew that Marcus Chalfin believed the exact opposite. Milat and Kevin were coming by train. Milat let the gang talk and said little.
Are you all right, Brother Milat?
Asked Hifan, finally, as the underground train came to a stop at Trafalgar Square and its doors slowly opened.
You've gone a strange colour.
Fine, fine, said Milat. But he was not fine. He was drunk.
Last night, he had found a bottle of whiskey in his bedroom. He had forgotten that it was there, and he had slowly been drinking it all through the day. But Shiva, who had now also joined Kevin, along with Mo Hussein Ishmael, the butcher, had done too much wild living himself and knew that something was wrong.
What have you been doing to yourself, Milat man?
He said as they walked out into Trafalgar Square. Milat looked straight ahead.
I'm just preparing myself, he said, because no one else will do it.
Shiva went silent. One of their members had been arrested last week, which told the group that the police were watching them. After that, they had decided to drop Plan A and had chosen Plan B instead, to read religious prayers in Arabic and then in English. Plan B made Milat sick.
And that's it, he said to them. You're just going to read prayers to him.
So that was why Milat was drunk, to make himself brave enough to do something else. His father had wanted to be someone important like Pandey, but instead he was a stupid one-handed waiter from Bangladesh. Milat was here to finish it, to turn that history around. If Marcus Chalfin was going to write his name all over the world, Milat was going to write his bigger. Milat and his friends from Kevin sat at the back of the Perry Institute. Joshua and Fate were sitting in the middle of the audience, which pissed Joshua off because of Crispin's bad planning. How would they get to the stage quickly when they had to get around all these people? Archie, Clara, Irie, Nina, Samad and Alsana took their seats a few rows back from the stage and waited, along with hundreds of other people. None of them were really happy to be there, but Nina had reminded them that Irie and Majid were both involved and, as family, they had to go and support them. In the end, Alsana decided for everybody. Archie and the rest were going whether they liked it or not.
When she heard these words, Irie began to cry. She cried a lot these days. And then she'd got angry on the bus when the two families had started arguing over something stupid.
"Shut up," she shouted. "Can't you see there are other people on this bus, and not everyone in this world wants to listen to you lot? Do you know how other families are? They are quiet. And I say lucky people, bloody lucky people."
"Irie Jones, watch your mouth,"
her mother had shouted, but Irie could not be stopped.
"What a joy their lives must be. They open a door and there is just space, not all these rooms full of history and all the things said in them years ago. They're not always making the same mistakes. They don't shout on buses. They don't care what their kids do. They just want them to be happy and healthy. They don't spend every day battling between who they are and who they should be and what they were and what they will be. No mosque, maybe a little church, no great-grandfathers. And do you know why? Because it doesn't matter. It's the past. They don't spend their time trying to fix it or change it. They just get on with their lives. Lucky, lucky people."
But there was a reason that Irie was angry one moment and crying the next, and she knew what that reason was. She was 8 weeks pregnant. What she did not know, and may never know, was the name of the father. No test could ever tell her. They both had the same thick black hair, the same shoe size, the same chocolate brown eyes. She could not know her body's decision or what choice it had made, because whichever brother it was the other one too. Milat and Majid. Majid and Milat. Majid? Milat. She would never know. And Irie had thought about this. If it was not somebody's child, could it be nobody's child? A child with no past that gave it a free future? And I'd like to thank you all, especially family and friends, for coming here to the Pere Institute on New Year's Eve to hear about this very exciting project, Marcus began. A row of scientists sat behind the table next to him. At the far end of the row sat a very old man with white hair. Milat watched the brothers of Kevin looking at each other. They were planning to start things in about 10 minutes, maybe 15, and were waiting for the signal from Hifan. But Milat was not waiting for the signal. He was a pandey deep inside, and there was mutiny in his heart. It had not been difficult to organise. 2 phone calls to some friends from the old gang, some Kevin money, and a trip to South London, and it was in his hand. It had been heavier than he had expected, but not such a frightening object. It had felt strangely normal. Of course, now he was here, and drunk, and scared, the gun did not feel so normal, and the right-hand pocket of his jacket was feeling very heavy. Because he was not Samad or Pandey. He hadn't had a war, and so had no stories to tell. He thought about Al Pacino in The Godfather, ready to run out of the men's toilet and shoot 2 men in the restaurant. There was a second when Pacino stopped to think, but it was only a second. He never did anything else but what he was supposed to do. Suddenly, from outside the Pere Institute, there came the sound of singing.
"Oh God," whispered Clara in her husband's ear. "It's Hortense. It's Hortense, Archie. You've got to go and stop them, please."
But Archie was enjoying himself watching Marcus. It was just like TV. Very interesting.
"Ask Irie," he replied.
But it was Samad who went. He did not want to listen to any more of Marcus's talk and was happy to leave the building. But when he got outside and moved towards the group of Jehovah's Witnesses, he was not feeling so sure.
"Mrs. Bowden," he said to Hortense, "I am a friend of Archibald Jones. My sons are friends of your granddaughter. My wife..."
"I know who you are,"
replied Hortense angrily.
It's just that we were hoping, continued Samad nervously, that you could bring the noise down a little.
But Hortense was already shouting over him.
There are two kinds of people, those that sing for the Lord and those that don't.
Then she stood and turned away towards the media, who were taking photos. Samad watched her, but he was suddenly too tired to say any more. He turned and went back inside the hall, just as Marcus was saying,
And so, if any one person should be thanked for this work, it's Dr. Marc-Pierre Perret, a very clever man and a very great...
Archie recognised the name, somewhere inside, and he immediately turned in his chair to look for Samad. He did not see him at first, but he saw Milat, who looked strange. He tried to smile at him, but Milat was looking straight past him at something or someone else. Then Archie turned back to the stage and realised that they were both staring at the same thing, an old man with white hair who was crying because he was so proud of his work. Suddenly, Archie recognised that face. But not before Samad recognised it too. Samad Iqbal, who had just stepped back into the hall and realised that the most important story of his life and of his best friend's life had all been a complete lie. This story will keep us friends for the next 40 years. It was the story to end all other stories. It was the story that kept on giving.
Archibald!
Shouted Samad, turning from the doctor and moving quickly towards Archie.
You lying, two-faced, bloody...
And at the same time, Irie also turned to see Joshua and Milat rising from their chairs and moving towards the stage. Milat was reaching into his pocket like Pandey so many years before him, but Archie moved quickly and was there before Samad could stop him. The bullet went straight into Archie's thigh, just as it had done 40 years ago, and for the second time, Archie found that he had saved Dr. Perret's life.